This is Professor Richard Carlson, and this is part two of the lecture for Thursday, July 7. When we left off, we had talked about the problem of realizing that the other party is very likely to breach, but your options are rather limited unless they have clearly repudiated the contract or they have taken one of those actions which renders them incapable of performing. There are many things short of either of those two possibilities that can make it pretty clear to you that it's very likely that they will breach the contract. What's the solution? Do you really have to continue your own performance? Must you really continue to deliver work or goods or money when you know there's a distinct possibility that you aren't going to get the return consideration? So we're beginning again now with this slide entitled Demanding Assurance If You Have Good Reason to Believe They Might Breach. Let's advance to the next slide. It's entitled A Demand for Assurance Rule Solution for Prospective Inability. Both the restatement and the code have different variations of this same idea, the idea of a demand for assurance. Now, let me say something at the outset that might be a little bit shocking, but it's absolutely true what's going on here, and it's the reason why we have to be very careful about the application of this rule. When we demand assurance, the effect is very much like unilaterally imposing new terms on the other party. You are, in essence, demanding that the party, other party, do things that they are not required to do under the contract, and you're threatening them with the idea that you will declare them in breach if they don't capitulate to your demands. Obviously, we want to reserve this kind of action only for cases that really demand it. Here's what the Restatement Second, Section 251 says. If an obligee has a reasonable basis to believe the obligor will commit total breach, he may, one, demand adequate assurance, that's certain affirmative actions by the other party to make it more likely that they will perform, and two, if reasonable, suspend performance and wait for the assurance. In other words, if you think that the other party is going to breach by performing too slow, you might say, look, unless you hire additional crew or demonstrate to me that you can rapidly accelerate your work by delivering additional supplies very quickly, I'm going to suspend all payments under this contract until you can show me that you can accomplish these things. Or suppose that it's the builder who is feeling insecure because he's learned that the buyer, the owner, may be short on cash. He could make a demand that the owner do something that the owner isn't required by the contract to do. For example, he could say, look, even though the contract says that you don't have to pay by pay until September 1, since I'm so insecure, I want you to place the entire amount of the purchase price in an escrow account at the following bank by tomorrow, or I will put down my tools and suspend my work. Now, if the obligee has acted reasonably and properly in making these kinds of demands, then a failure by the obligor to give the demanded assurance equals repudiation. The code in section 2-609 adopts a similar rule, but it requires that the demand must be in writing, and it implies a 30-day limit in order for the obligor to respond to the demand. Next slide. Pittsburgh Des Moines Steel versus Brookhaven Manor Company. Has the buyer's finances sprung a leak? This is one of those cases where the buyer suddenly looks financially weak, and it makes the seller of the goods feel very uneasy. Next slide. PDMS versus Brookhaven Manor, a seller's alleged insecurity. This case is also a good illustration of how we have to be very careful about approving a party's demand for assurance, because in the background I can tell you what's going on in this case. The seller of the water filter here was negotiating a contract, and the seller was very eager, I should say his sales department was very eager to get this deal done, and they made concessions that ordinarily the company would not have approved. How did this contract get approved when the sales department made concessions that are, in retrospect, surprising? Well, we will never know the answer to that question. Here's the concession that was made. The buyer doesn't have to pay until the goods are substantially delivered and installed. Considering that these are custom-made goods, this water filter is made and designed just for this particular buyer, this is putting the manufacturer really way out on a limb. Ordinarily, you would either want some progress payments, maybe even payment in advance, or at least some kind of vehicle for assuring that the money would really be there when you're finished, perhaps to put the money into an escrow account, perhaps for what we call a letter of credit from a bank guaranteeing payment upon a certain event. But the seller didn't negotiate for any of these things. And later on, you can imagine what happens when the other managers at the company find out what their sales force has done. They're outraged, and they want to go back and they want to rewrite the deal, but it's too late because, as you learned in contract one, once the deal is done, neither party has the power unilaterally to demand a change in the terms. So we're led to believe, based on the court's description of the events in this case, that perhaps the seller starts scurrying around looking for an excuse to impose new terms on the buyer, and their strategy, of course, is going to make to make a demand for assurance. So let's work our way through the bullets on this particular slide. Remember, initially the seller had wanted certain terms of payment to make them secure, but they retreated from that in order to get the deal closed. Later, they realize that they've made a mistake and they want to rewrite the contract, but it's too late, so they have to allege some new grounds for insecurity. They have to say, look, all of a sudden, something that has happened that makes us believe that the buyer is going to breach. Now, they might be right about this, even if the events that make them feel so insecure are because of reasons or events beyond the obligor's control. Maybe it's a financial crisis, for example, that has suddenly made the buyer less financially able. But as we'll see, that didn't really happen in this case. Anyway, the seller therefore makes multiple new demands of the buyer, including, for example, having the president of the company sign an agreement that would make him personally liable, the guarantor of the corporation's debts, some additional payment into some kind of an escrow account and so forth. A number of things that are exactly the sort of thing that a seller might have negotiated at the outset, but is not in fact required by this contract. Next slide. Is there cause for insecurity, and are the demands reasonable? We have these two separate requirements. Number one, is there cause for insecurity? Well, what the seller says is that we've learned that your application for a loan has been disapproved. So we might ask, is this a new event that is something that gives cause for insecurity? The answer is that in this case, the court's not persuaded that that was really the case. Because after all, maybe the seller was making multiple applications. Also, we don't really know why the loan application was disapproved. Maybe the bank simply wasn't willing to provide the terms that the seller really wanted, and a new application would be perfectly okay. In any event, the court says, for the most part, the things that you're talking about are things that you already knew at the time that you negotiated the contract. You have to focus on something that has happened since you negotiated the contract, and it has to be something, some new event that in and of itself gives you new grounds for insecurity, and what you've alleged here is probably not enough. Now, if we're governed by the code, of course, we'd also have to require that the demand had to be in writing. We'd also have to make sure that the demands that were made by the seller were reasonable and not excessive. And in this case, the court concludes that the seller went overboard, assuming that the lack of financing approval was in fact grounds for security. We might want to ask, well, what would be an appropriate or reasonable demand for assurance? And maybe the answer is, inform us of what other methods of financing you have in mind, or inform us of what the reasons were for the denial of the loan application, or give us some letter from the bank which shows that the approval of the next application is very likely. There are any number of things that might work at this point that would be much less demanding than what the seller was asking for. So what happens if you you go too far? If you demand assurance when you weren't insecure, and you demand too much even if you were insecure, the answer is that your demands and your threats to suspend or terminate performance constitute your own repudiation. Because after all, remember what you've just said here, if you don't capitulate to my new demands, I won't perform. And of course, if you're demanding things that you have no right to demand, and you're threatening to breach as part of that threat, then you have in effect repudiated your obligations. Next slide. We move now to the topic of substantial fulfillment of a constructive condition. Maybe a contractor should get points for being substantially there. Remember that I've explained that constructive conditions are different from the conditions that are the product of the party's own particular bargaining. And the really big difference is the standard of fulfillment. What do we require in order to be able to say that the condition has been satisfied? Now, looking back over the last 20 years of contracts to exams, this is where I see the most trouble that students have in contracts too. They forget that there's a difference between an express or implied condition that is the product of actual bargaining by the parties versus a constructive condition that the court imposes simply as a way of setting the order of performance and of making sure that one party has adequately performed before we require the other party to put itself at risk. So, do we give the contractor points for being substantially there? And the answer is, well, sometimes we do. Sometimes close does count in the case of constructive conditions. Next slide, a constructive condition problem. At the outset, let me explain that this problem is designed to explain why it is that with constructive conditions, we might want to be more flexible. We might want to allow close to count. Read the facts, and then I'll explain the answer. Now, remember what would have happened if the parties had explicitly negotiated the following condition. Suppose the contract said, I, the buyer, will not have to pay unless you deliver exactly according to these specifications, and it is a condition of my duty to pay any amount that you have complied exactly with the contract. If the parties explicitly negotiated such a condition to the buyer's duty, then we'd be stuck with the usual rule that close does not count. But this is a case where, based on these facts at least, the parties haven't negotiated an explicit condition. We would have a constructive condition, of course, assuming the parties haven't said otherwise. In this case, we have to have a simultaneous tender of goods in return for money, but look at what's happened. The seller is trying to tender something that's close but not perfect. If the parties haven't negotiated an express condition for this situation, we could make a good argument for saying that it's better to require both parties to complete their performance at this stage than to disrupt the entire transaction over a single miscolored widget out of 3,000. And our explanation would be that it's much more efficient to require each party to finish the performance at this stage, and then allow the buyer to sue for damages if, in fact, he has been hurt. Because, as we can well imagine, it may very well be that that shortage of a widget, because we have the exact number of widgets, one of them is the wrong color. Will the buyer actually suffer any injury if it accepts all these widgets and pays for them? And the answer is, that's probably very speculative. So that's perhaps the better approach. Require the buyer to pay, accept delivery of the widgets, and then if the buyer does in fact suffer any damage, he can sue the seller for the amount of his actual loss. Next slide. This takes us to Atkinson versus Jackson Brothers, which is an example of what we call the doctrine of substantial performance. You might think of it as substantially a touchdown. This is a case of a construction contract in which some minor defects have disappointed the buyers, and if you've had construction work, you know that there are going to be at least some minor disappointments. Does this discharge the buyer's duty to pay? Is it then a failure of a constructive condition of the buyer's duty to pay the builder? Well, if it had been an express condition, remember that courts enforce express conditions exactly according to their terms. But if we required perfection in every aspect of the performance, especially where the parties haven't explicitly negotiated an express condition, the result would often be a severe forfeiture, particularly for a builder who can't take his work back. Moreover, there are probably better ways of dealing with breach in this case, particularly if it's not a serious breach. For example, it may be that we can continue to move forward with the contract, the owner will continue to make progress payments, the builder will continue to do the work, and in the meantime, we'll be working out a solution that will cure the breach, and to the extent that this requires any money out of the buyer's pocket, we can compensate the buyer with some kind of a set-off, either later on by withholding a portion of a future payment, or perhaps by a lawsuit that is just based on the amount of the actual damage suffered by the owner. This, of course, means that if perfection is your condition of your duty to pay, you must be clear. You need to have an express condition. Next slide, Atkinson versus Jackson. When is it substantially done? Well, here is a Texas court's description of what we call substantial performance. And this is reasonably in accord with what we would find just about anywhere else. The defects in question are not pervasive. We don't have a major deviation from the general plan. In fact, for example, it was a house with three bedrooms, and we actually got that. We didn't get a house with only one bedroom. The defects do not impair the structure or function of the project as a whole. In other words, it's still useful for its intended purpose. It's not like the Leaning Tower of Pisa, where it has become dangerous to use. The defects can be remedied. In other words, it makes sense to continue to move forward in this contract with the future prospect of curing the breach by one means or another, or simply by the buyer paying or getting a credit for just the amount of his actual loss. And finally, we're going to apply this doctrine mainly where the breaching party has acted in good faith. Now, don't confuse that with intentional versus unintentional breach, because a lot of good faith breaches are, in fact, intentional. We are worried here about motivation. Did the breaching party breach because he was trying to cheat the owner, for example, steal money from him, or was there some excusable good reason for having breached, or was it pure oversight on his part? Another case that is a classic illustration of the doctrine of substantial performance is Jacob and Youngs versus Kent. We've read that case before, and in fact, that case is also about this problem of substantial performance, because you can recall what the defect was there. It was a rather minor defect. The builder used the wrong kind of pipe, but it was pipe of equal quality to that specified in the contract. Was this substantial performance sufficient to trigger the owner's duty to pay? And the answer is yes. The court there held that the builder's work was, in fact, sufficient to fulfill the constructive condition of the owner's duty to pay. Now, that's without prejudice to his right to prove that he's actually suffered a loss, and he's entitled to an offset, either against the amount that he still owes under the contract, if he can prove his loss, if he's had out-of-pocket expense, perhaps he can bring a later lawsuit. And you'll remember in that case that we concluded that the owner's damages were rather negligible, because in applying the doctrine of economic waste, the court held that the owner was at best entitled to the difference in value, which was very, very small. Let's go on to the next slide. Material breach factors. Here's the beginning of a list of factors that the courts consider when they're determining whether or not we've had substantial performance. Now, when the question is whether or not the builder or other performing party has substantially performed sufficiently to satisfy the constructive condition of an owner's duty to pay, there are primarily four factors that we look at, and the first is the injured party's loss of benefit. In what way has the owner, the payor, received something other than or less than what was promised to him? Courts sometimes distinguish trivial versus material, pervasive or not pervasive. They will compare the defect with the injured party's main purpose in the contract. For example, how important is the brand of pipe, considering that the main purpose of the contract is a house in which you will live? Is the work still of use and value to the buying party? And the answer is, well, yes. In the case of Jacob and Young's, you are actually living in the house, and the use of the wrong brand of pipe has not impaired its usability or its value, and it hasn't impaired the structure. What are the likely damages in comparison with the contract price? And the answer in Jacob and Young's, for example, was a minimal amount of damages. That would be, therefore, an overreaction to completely deny the builder his right to any part of a contract price. Next slide introduces the second factor. Is this breach curable or compensable? Is the defect one that can be easily cured, either by the owner, the builder, or perhaps by a third party? And if and when it's fixed or cured, can it be translated into dollars? Or if it's a difference in value situation like it was in Jacob and Young's, is it something that can be measured easily in dollars so that we can simply subtract that from the amount that remains due under the contract? And is that a practical solution? Remember that we're choosing between allowing the owner to simply withhold or sue for the amount of actual loss versus his right to completely deny any payment at all under the contract. And if we can easily just withhold a certain amount or sue for a specific amount of actual loss, that will often make more sense, be more efficient, and be more fair than completely refusing to pay any amount at all. Next slide. This is the third factor, the forfeiture to the breaching party. If we treat this as a complete constructive condition failure, so that the owner doesn't have to pay anything still due under the contract, the result is that the builder receives nothing for valuable work that he's performed, and he can't take it back. He can't reclaim it to sell it to somebody else. And that's what we mean again by a forfeiture. We compare that forfeiture with the amount that the injured party has actually been hurt, his actual provable loss. And in a case like Jacob and Young's, the forfeiture to the builder, the value of his uncompensated services, is many, many, many times greater than the rather speculative amount of Ken's loss in having the wrong brand of pipe. Next slide is the fourth factor, breaching party's good faith. In particular, was the breach beyond the breaching party's control? Was it inadvertent, a simple negligence? If it was intentional, was its purpose to shortchange the injured party? And remember that sometimes an intentional breach can be for a good reason, such as, you know, well, my mother is dying in California, and I had to interrupt my work to go out and take care of her. Next slide. Plant versus Jacobs is an opportunity to apply these four factors to see how we would come out with the same set of facts. Must the buyers pay for a house that doesn't measure up? Remember, the builder didn't build a house according to specifications. One room is about a foot wider. Another room, as a consequence, is a foot shorter. We just placed one of the interior walls in the wrong spot. Next slide, Plant versus Jacobs. Was it a material breach? Let's see how we arrive at the condition or the question of substantial performance. The Jacobs have refused to pay because of alleged defects in the builder's construction. And that brings us to the question, well, has there been substantial performance satisfying the constructive condition of their duty to pay, or did he materially breach so that the condition has not been satisfied? Well, there are a number of breaches, as there frequently will be in a construction case, so it's best just to focus on the really big one in a case like this. One room is too long, and another room is too short. For a case like this, and certainly if it was the problem on the exam, you would go back and apply the four factors from exactly the four preceding slides. Next slide, applying our factors. What's the loss of benefit? Well, the house is still habitable for the Jacobs. They probably are not really all that upset by the misplacement of the wall because they used a stock plan. In other words, it wasn't designed particularly for their tastes. There's lack of evidence of any other loss to the plans. They didn't do a good job, perhaps as well as they might have, of proving how they were hurt by the misplacement of the wall. You can imagine there might be other ways of proving this. You know, we already hired an interior decorator to design the room around these particular dimensions, and now all of that work has gone to waste. Secondly, is this a curable or compensable loss? Well, it certainly isn't curable because fixing the wall would be so destructive and wasteful. Measurement of the plants, or the measurement of the plants' loss in value would be difficult here, because their loss is mainly aesthetic, and that tends to weigh in their favor because it is so difficult to prove a loss that we do feel they may have suffered that it's not really practical to require them to file a lawsuit. Will there be a forfeiture for the builder? Excuse me if I have the parties' names backward on that slide there. I'm going to try to correct that before I post them. It's is there a forfeiture by plant the builder, and of course it's the Jacobs then who are the parties who are suffering the loss. Anyway, there probably will be a significant forfeiture for the builder plant because he's done work again that he can't just retrieve. We don't know if the breach was in good faith or not, probably because there's just no evidence to explain how it happened. These things do happen. It was probably inadvertent. It's hard to imagine any other reason why he would have done it on purpose. Next slide, contracts for sale of goods. Are they different from other contracts? Once again, we find out that the rules are slightly different when we move from construction to the sale of goods. And here's the reason why our rule for constructive conditions might be a little bit different in the case of a sale of goods. First of all, contract specifications likely can be satisfied perfectly in a contract for the sale of goods. This is especially true in the case of commodities because one bar of gold or one barrel of oil or one quantity of propane is pretty much like the next. Secondly, minor deviations are more likely to have a very large impact on value or to render the goods useless to the buyer in a contract for sale of goods. Minor delay is more likely to affect market value. And we don't have to worry so much about forfeiture to the seller in a case like this because typically when we're dealing with goods, we're talking about things which, if rejected by the buyer, can now be resold in a substitute transaction by the seller. Next slide. This brings us to Printing Center versus Supermind, which illustrates some problems in the application of the rule of constructive conditions in a contract for sale of goods, and it illustrates how the code is different. By the way, the picture in that slide is a famous picture of an error that actually multiplied the value of goods by about 1,000,000 times. That's one of the most valuable stamps ever printed by the U.S. Post Office. Next slide. Printing Center versus Supermind, the perfect tender rule. What we have in the code is a different rule for constructive conditions. It's something much closer to what we require for express conditions. And actually, it's somewhere in between the rule of perfect fulfillment of an express condition and substantial performance of constructive conditions. The code preserves a rule known as the perfect tender rule, and you'll see it in section 2-601. The the buyer can reject and refuse to pay for goods if the tender of the delivery of the goods fails in any respect to conform to the contract. Now, it's important that we're talking about non-conformities and not necessarily anything that you might regard as a defect. There are a lot of ways that goods might be disappointing to you, but unless the disappointment is because of a non-conformity, something that's different about the goods in comparison with what the contract actually says, then there hasn't been a non-conformity. In the printing center case, however, the court adds a further requirement, something which other courts have done. This issue hasn't come up widely enough for us to say that the rule is universal, but it does seem to be a popular rule, and that is that even though the buyer can invoke the perfect tender rule in rejecting goods and refusing to pay for them if they don't perfectly correspond with the contract, the buyer has to do this in good faith, which suggests that even under the code, the condition of the buyer's duty to pay might have been fulfilled by something less than perfection if we think that the buyer's rejecting the goods only because he's looking for an easy excuse to get out of the contract. Next slide. Perfect tender does not mean perfect goods. The issue, again, is whether there is a non-conformity with the specifications or warranties of the contract. Is the defect that you're talking about something that breaches either a precise term of the contract or a warranty? Consider, for example, a scratch in your brand new car. Well, in order for that to be a non-conformity, either the contract must say there will be no scratches, and frankly, I've never seen a car contract that said that, or we must be able to say that the scratch violates the implied or express warranty of merchantability. Now, remember what the warranty of merchantability requires. It requires something less of perfection. In other words, would a car with that kind of scratch pass without objection by most buyers in the market? Thus, an imperfection or buyer's dissatisfaction alone will not necessarily constitute a non-conformity with the contract. And remember that implied warranties typically require only an average or passing quality. Back to Printing Center versus Supermind in our next slide, a checklist for conformity. It's important to remember that contracts include both written and unwritten terms, and all of those become part of the specifications. We start with the question, did the printing job violate particular specifications of the contract? Did it say that the material would be printed in a certain way? Secondly, maybe there is a custom that is an implicit part of a contract that sets a certain threshold for quality. You know, the appearance of the printing has to achieve a certain standard. Did the printer act in bad faith? Did the books violate implied warranties based perhaps on samples that were presented to the buyer before he made the contract? And finally, did the books violate the implied warranty of merchantability? Next slide is a problem. Take a moment to read that and turn this back on again when you're ready to think and talk about the answer. Well, I think we've already answered this problem pretty well by our previous discussion. Contracts that I've seen, at least, typically do not say that the car will be free of any scratches, so we're really left to implied terms or the implied warranty of merchantability. And remember that the implied warranty of merchantability requires only that the goods be of passing or average quality and that they could pass without objection from a substantial number of the buying public. Next slide. Printer Center versus Supermind. Excuse me, that was our last slide, so we're finished with this lecture. I'll be sending you an email probably on Friday, a follow-up message, which will give you a better sense of where we will be reaching for our class on Monday. Enjoy your weekend in the meantime.